You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative talents at one of the world's great opera companies. For additional podcast interviews, subscribe to our RSS feed or visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Stage director Paul Curran is backstage at Lyric.
What attracted me to Lulu itself was first and foremost the music. And if anybody thinks this is plinkety plinkety bum 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 type of music, it couldn't be anything further from that.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. In this episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Paul Curran, who's returned to Lyric this season as stage director of the new production of Berg's Lulu. Paul made his Lyric debut last season with another new production, Die Frauen Schatten. He's one of the most sought-after opera directors in the world, with successes from Santa Fe and Toronto to Milan and St. Petersburg. He was also recently appointed artistic director of the Norwegian Opera in Oslo. Before we play the interview, here's a brief synopsis of Lulu. What's happened before Lulu begins is that Lulu, in her early teens, is found on the street and taken in by Dr. Schön. He's a respected newspaper editor. He gives her the wherewithal to have a decent life. When she's a few years older, he begins an affair with her, but then he chooses to marry her off to old Dr. Gall. In the opera's prologue, an animal tamer introduces his animals, and Lulu is the serpent. In the opera's first scene, when Dr. Gall discovers Lulu and a painter making love, he collapses and dies. The painter then marries Lulu, but she continues her liaison with Dr. Schön. But he plans to marry a young woman from a respectable family. When he tells Lulu he wants her out of his life, she's unwilling to give him up. He tells the painter about his affair with Lulu, and the miserable painter kills himself. At Lulu's insistence, Schön gives up his fiancée. He marries Lulu, although she continues to receive many admirers, including the wealthy Countess Geschwitz and Schön's own son, Alva. Lulu's behavior so enrages Schön that he finally gives her a revolver and orders her to shoot herself. She kills him instead. But even though Alva's horrified by that, he still can't resist his feelings for Lulu. She escapes the police by running away with Alva and Geschwitz to Paris. When she has to escape again, she winds up in London as a poor streetwalker. Alva is killed by one of her clients. Lulu brings home another client, Jack the Ripper, who kills her. Geschwitz is killed by Jack as well, and she dies declaring that she will be with her beloved Lulu forever. Now, on to the interview with Paul Curran. I hope you enjoy it. I'm here with Paul Curran, director of our new production of Lulu at Lyric, which is opening tonight, and the excitement is building. We had a thrilling dress rehearsal, and I want to congratulate you. It's going to be, I think, something that our audience will remember always.
Thank you very much. I hope so. I'll remember it.
Now, this piece is such a huge challenge on every level, musically, dramatically, visually. I mean, what drew you to it in the first place?
What drew me to Lulu?
Yes.
The challenge and, you know, anything that's really about sex, drugs and rock and roll gets my vote. So I'm happy with, you know, exploring and discovering that. But really what drew me to this piece, I must say, was the music. First and foremost was the music. I love the music of this piece.
Which you heard for the first time when?
I first heard Lulu in 1981 at Covent Garden in a Gutz Friedrich production with Karen Armstrong. His wife. But the very first opera I saw was Wozzeck, also by Berg, when I was 15 years old. And I was so thrilled with Wozzeck at Scottish Opera. One lot conducted by Sir Alexander Gibson, the founder of Scottish Opera, and the other lot was conducted by a young unknown called Simon Rattle. at the time. And I was so thrilled with it that I went back to see every single performance. So what attracted me to Lulu itself was first and foremost the music.
And if there were sections of it that you could mention which you think are as beautiful in themselves as anything in the operatic repertoire, what would be the first to come to your mind?
For sure it would be the end of Act Two, the very end of Act
which
Two.
Is...
The duet between Lulu and Alva, where I don't know if they fall in love or they fall in lust or whatever's going on there, I don't really know, but it's a very, very sensual and as sensual and beautiful a piece of lyric writing as you can ever imagine. And if anybody thinks this is plinkety plinkety bum 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 type of music, it couldn't be anything further from that.
Doesn't he have what Berg called a hymn where he talks about her body in terms of music?
Yeah, he has this fantastic aria where he's a composer, and I would say he's a kind of a mediocre composer, so he's a little bit pretentious within the piece. But the hymn he has is he describes each part of his body as being a musical value, like a rhapsody, or he describes her knees. Basically, it's a huge, big sort of sexual hymn to Lulu. And within the production, of course, I have Lulu taking off various bits of clothing. Before you start thinking, oh my God, is she absolutely naked? She certainly is not. I asked Marlies Petersen, our Lulu, I said, are you okay with wearing this underwear? Because we said it in the 1930s, does it make you feel very naked? And she said, naked? I've never worn so much clothing in my life. There's tights, there's shoes, there's tops, there's this, there's that. But she said it made her feel unbelievably sexy. So I hope we reflected the music within the physicality.
I mean, in the production, what are the most important qualities of this figure, Lulu, that you want to emphasize?
She has to be a creature of some mystery and yet some simplicity. She has to be sexy. It's like Billy Budd. You can't do Billy Budd without a sexy Billy Budd. The guy has to be sexy. He has to be the sort of guy that even other guys are looking at and under their breath saying, he looks great. That's the same quality for Lulu. She needs to be of that quality that is alluring to everybody. Man, woman, beast, it doesn't matter. So that's an important thing. The other thing to point out in this, and I've tried to do it in some scenes with the figure of the 15-year-old girl, is that this cycle of prostitution and of abuse, because this girl is abused, whichever way you look at it, she is very, very badly abused. This cycle never stops. It never stops today. It never stops anywhere. And that's something I've tried to point out, that throughout the piece, her journey goes very high in Paris, and then she's a prostitute, a streetwalker in London. I think that's vital.
Now, so she has this very steep rise and this equally steep fall. So in her progress, if you want to call it that, through the opera, what are the pivotal moments for this character where things change in significant way?
All the pivotal things are that she meets one man after another. What I find remarkable about the character is as one husband dies, they all die in her presence, she moves on to the next one as if the previous one wasn't even there, as if he'd just been visiting. She has this remarkable, some would call it cold-hearted way of emotionally detaching from every man she's ever been with. What I find fascinating about that is, how do you define that? Is that cold-hearted or is that just survival? Because we know when this girl was first taken into prostitution, she was 12 years old. So is that just survival? And I think that's worth exploring. I think that's vital.
Now, you've talked before about this opera being just as much about men as it is about her.
Yeah.
I mean, what does this libretto tell us about how men view this character?
What does it tell us about men? We're all pigs. It's true. We're all pigs. What it tells me about men is that this opera and the Wedekind plays were written about men's desires and what drives men. I mean, if you go back to basic psychology and basic biology, men are made for one thing, women are made for another. This opera explores the fact that men get rather blinded and do get led by their uncompromising desires, where emotion goes out the window and the only emotion is lust. And I think it's a very interesting exploration of that lust. What I find equally interesting for me as a man is that I see myself in all of these men. I'm equally guilty, if you can call it guilty, as any of these men of lusting after other people. And equally, there's a little bit of Lulu in Paul somewhere. Certainly when I was younger, well, maybe at 44, not so much now, but there certainly was when I was younger. And I find that fascinating because it teaches me a lot about my relationships within the world, my relationships to other people.
Going back to the music for a second, how long did it actually take you to absorb this score into yourself to the point where you could actually do the staging without constantly referring to the score? I mean, you've lived with it for a while now, but how long did it take you before you really sort of got it?
I never think I get it. I'm always the sort of person that says, oh, I don't know the music. Every singer and every conductor I've ever worked with say to me, how did you memorize this? You seem to always know it. But I'm a bit of a perfectionist in that. So I always find that there's more to discover within the score as I go along. Prime example is, I was talking to Wolfgang Schöne the other day at the dress rehearsal.
He's our Dr. Schön.
And Wolfgang said to me, he came up and he said, oh, I had an idea for the first scene of Act 2. There's this other bit in the music and I didn't even realize it was there and I thought I would just try this moment. Is that okay? And I said, Wolfgang, you've done 9 productions of this opera. 9. And today, you're discovering at the dress rehearsal a new bar of music that you never thought was there before. Well, yes, I discover this every day. And that's pretty much the same for me. We discover it all the time.
It works in such extremes, this piece. So what is it like for you and your cast to be dealing with those emotions and with this music for weeks at a time?
Well, you kind of... It's like doing a Woody Allen movie, isn't it? You can't be intense all day. I mean, you cannot do murder and destruction and prostitution all day because you'd go off your head. You'd go crazy. It's too much negative energy and it's too, nerves. Your nerves would be screaming. How we've got through it and how I think it works best, and within the production I think it works best, is in contrast. I always talk to the singers about contrast. So I make people laugh a lot. You've been to my rehearsals. We're always laughing. And the reason we're always laughing is because laughter releases tension. And the only way you can make tension is by creating it. You can't live in tension. So a simple rehearsal process of mine and technique is to just laugh at ourselves all the way through it so that when we do have to get intense and heavy, you can build it up fast and quickly, and then you drop it again. That way, it creates proper drama. It doesn't just create hysteria.
I should emphasize, too, that it's not 100% heavy duty in this piece because there are a fair number of episodes where there's a comic element.
Oh, well, the whole of Act 2 is a farce. It's a 3-door Fado farce. It's like the Marx Brothers. It's people hiding behind screens, under tables, in windows, you name it. And it's about a guy with a gun coming out, deciding who to shoot and who not to shoot. It's like watching the Marx Brothers Duck Soup. It's hilarious. I think it's hilarious. And actually, it was by far the most complicated thing to rehearse, was the timing. Comic timing is so difficult, but it has to be precise. It's as precise as a belly dancer. You cannot just let it happen.
You have Marlis Petersen doing Lulu. You have Wolfgang Schröne, and they've done a lot of performances.
Yeah, indeed,
they're so experienced in these roles. So how do the ideas that they have developed over time affect the work that you're doing? Are they perfectly willing to approach this piece as if they've never done it before?
Well, with those two, actually, they did. They very much did. They very much came. Of course, by the time you get into a rehearsal room with a director, you don't know this person. If you've never worked with them before, you don't know this person. I may have decided it was all going to be set in Planet of the Apes and everybody was going to be in white leather and they're all going to have motorcycle helmets. So I would find that quite alarming if somebody came up with that idea with me, because it takes a lot to get into it. These two, though, they, I must say, approached it very much as a blank page. I knew Marlis from London. I'd met her in London. So we sort of knew each other briefly. But interestingly, they had both done their homework on me. So they knew the sort of productions I did and they'd read up and spoken to a few people about me. And it really was just a meeting of minds, I must say, because they were very open. They've both said the same thing to me, which I find interesting, because I just see it as what I do. But they've both said they've never done a production of it with quite so many details, quite so many acting details. And I think that comes from... We talked on the first day about language. I said there are 3 languages in this piece, and in any piece, but particularly in this. There's the spoken language that you communicate in. There's the musical language that the composer communicates with us in, and which not necessarily you communicate with each other in. And the third language is what you as actors communicate to each other and to us in, body language. And it's that body language and the details of mixing the three, I think, that's made this Who knows? I hope people love it tonight, but it's made it a wonderful process for me to be part of.
I mean, as far as body language is concerned, I mean, you are an ex-dancer and you do all, you create the movement in your productions yourself. So in this production, have there been any special challenges as far as the whole movement element? I mean, you have Marlis who moves exquisitely. Have you created a specific style of movement for Lulu?
Yes, because the movement is very, especially for Lulu and for Gishwitz, for the wonderful Jill Grove, it's very much a movement that is determined by the clothes they wear. If you're sitting in a pair of jeans and a t-shirt, you're going to sit there like a slob. If you're sitting in an exquisitely coutured and tailored 1930s suit, as Jill is, then you can't sit there like a slob. You actually have to sit in a very particular way. And that then defines how your character's physicality is going to be. Equally with Marlis, she's in a series of, her clothes start off quite plain and they become a series of more and more elegant gowns throughout the evening. And that really determines how you move. Interestingly, Marlis is a very beautiful and a very sexy lady, but actually we had to show her at one point. I had to show her how to actually stand in the dress. At one point, because it's the way a dress is cut, and you'll always see ladies of the 30s and 40s have a knee slightly forward and their bodies are never straight on, they're always twisted. Why? Because it creates what in classical painting is called an arabesque. It creates a twist throughout the body that shows off the curves. Nobody wants to see anything flat.
You and your designer, Kevin Knight, have worked a great deal together.
So 22 shows.
Wow. So visually, the two of you have moved the piece up by a couple of decades to the 1930s. So how did you go about determining what this production was really going to look like?
It was not easy. Not easy at all. We always start off with where it's supposed to be set and see if that means anything to us for a start. Directing and design is about taste. It's real simple. It's not about getting it right. It can be set in Planet of the Apes if Planet of the Apes makes sense. Whoever thought that Rigoletto would make sense in the 1950s on the waterfront? But Jonathan Miller did it, and I was at the opening night, and it was truly one of the most thrilling opening nights you've ever seen in your life. It really worked. Equally with this, you can go back to the 19th century with it when Wedekind set the plays, or you can look and see what makes more sense. For me, entirely modern in this doesn't make huge sense because there are not the great social levels that you have within Wedekind's plays and within certainly Berg's time in the 1930s. You're also talking 1934 by the time he finished it, of a time when the world was changing profoundly. Think of what was written in 1934. Porgy and Bess was written in 1934. I think Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk was written in 1934. Anything Goes was written in 1934. It was a really amazing time in history when the female was becoming, unlike the romantic operas of the 19th century, by far the active protagonist of the piece, and the exploration of women was becoming much more to the forefront. So we needed an era where the woman was the central figure of fascination and the men were the ancillary characters. And I think the most thing that we talked about were the 1930s, where women really were coming in business and in all sorts of ways were coming forward. Watch a movie like Woman of the Year, Katharine Hepburn, fascinating movie. I mean, really relevant today. How do we deal with career and relationships all at the same time? So that was the process that Kevin and I went. We always go through a torturous process. Of course we do. And we throw out the first big idea, of course, we threw out. And I think this was about idea development, let's say, number three.
You have created in this opera a really amazing ensemble. I mean, people seem so completely united in the rehearsals that I've seen. You've talked about laughter being an element in keeping everybody relaxed and comfortable. Are there any other elements of your rehearsal process that create this ensemble feeling?
I don't know. I suppose you'd need to ask them, really. But I think I sort of believe the piece is greater than any of us. I really do. I think we are slaves to the piece. I don't think any of us ever have the definitive answer to how it should be done. I cannot stand when people say to me, it should be like this. This is how it goes. No, I'm sorry. Even a building in daylight is not seen in two shots the same way. If you stand at two sides of the building, you'll see two different views of a building. So it can be anything. I think what I do is I encourage people within certain boundaries. I do set up boundaries of interpretation of behavior, but I love them to explore within it. And when singers feel a freedom within that, they start to grow. and they start to grow big time. And we had the same last year in Frauen und Schatten, and certainly at the Santa Fe operas, if you've seen those, then the Billy Budd cast and the Peter Grimes cast were all very sort of, you know, much an ensemble, but you feel as if they're individuals within it. I hate straitjacketing people. I couldn't possibly say you have to lift your finger in this bar of the music, because that makes no sense to me.
Well, I want to wish you all the best for this production of Lulu. It's a piece we haven't done here in 2 decades.
Yes.
And it's a very momentous occasion for us. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.